welcome to episode 76 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I'm a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. It's been a while since the last episode, but it's been an unusual summer. I've been in more meetings, certainly, than I can count regarding COVID-19 and reopening of the university, all kinds of logistics. So it's been a strange time. And a lot of my normal work has been pushed aside a bit. But I'm very pleased to be combining once again with the Historias podcast. If you're not familiar with the Historias podcast, then you really should be. It's the podcast coming out of the Southeastern Council of Latin American Studies. And if anybody knows me, then you know that I've been a long time member of SECOLAS, active member. I've been the editor of the peer-reviewed journal, The Latin Americanist, for, 15 years? And they really got a crack group of folks who are working on the podcast. And so one of those members who's been working on is Dustin Walcher. He invited me to participate in a group discussion about Trump and Latin America. And we were with my friend Maggie Cummins down the road at Queen's University, Mary Rose Kubel, and Jeff Taffet, to just kind of go over, sort of what the policy of the Trump administration is, how we can characterize it, where it seems to be going, and the like. Racism, as you might imagine, gets included in part of that discussion. And so I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed making it. And again, make sure that you go and check out the Historias podcast. They got a ton of stuff. They're way over me. They got over 100 episodes. So there's plenty in there to use. And incidentally, I mean, same with mine, but with theirs, it's especially now that schools are online, it's a great addition to any class. They cover all kinds of different topics. So if it's something that your students might enjoy, take a look through all of the subjects that they've been dealing with and even drop one of us a line if you're using it, because I think it's a great resource for instructors, not just those who are interested in Latin America. But with that, let's move on to the discussion.
Welcome to Historias, the podcast from the Southeastern Council of Latin American Studies. I'm your host, Dustin Walcher, and today we're talking about the Donald J. Trump administration's policies towards Latin America. I'm pleased to be joined by a stellar panel that includes Dr. Maggie Cummins, Associate Professor of Political Science at Queen's University of Charlotte, Dr. Mary Rose Kubel, Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the International Studies Program at St. Bonaventure University, Dr. Jeffrey Taffet, a historian and professor of humanities at the United States Merchant Marine Academy, and Dr. Greg Weeks, professor of political science and associate dean for academic affairs in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. All right, well, welcome to the program, and I think it probably makes the most sense to dive right in. Latin America is, of course, a large, diverse region, in some ways more so than is often sort of portrayed in media in the United States. But having said that, is it possible to identify and characterize any kind of general policy approach from the Trump administration towards Latin America? Maggie, do you want to start us off with this one?
Sure. I actually just spent a little bit of time on the State Department website looking at the most recent things that they've put out about Latin America, and it seems that the policy is focused overwhelmingly on Cuba, Venezuela, and so the policy is couched in terms of promotion for democracy and respect for self-determination in the region, but it's very much a policy such as what we've seen in the past that's dominated by a few countries, and it's dominated by some form of anti-communism. Anti-socialism.
Yeah, I mean, I'll jump in. One thing too, kind of going along with that, is that I think there's a lot of talking tough, not doing a lot, but it seems almost entirely aimed at Trump's reelection. So you want to say, all right, I'm going to say things that are going to get me some attention in Florida. I'm going to talk about Brazil I'm going to talk about trade with Mexico or immigration. And a lot of these things never come to pass, but the idea is just to have something that Trump can point to for his own constituency, his own rather narrow constituency.
So it's about sort of right wingers in Cuba in Florida, former Cubans and so on, and the traditional anti-communist or anti-socialist bent of GOP platforms.
Yeah, and just a good old xenophobia.
Oh yeah, I would agree, but I would also say, because I was sort of thinking about this and preparing, and I feel like, you know, I agree with Greg. There isn't really a general policy approach in the sense of a clear sort of affirmative agenda, right? I mean, not even in a like negative affirmative agenda, like a drug war, right? I mean, it's just like Maggie, as you said. I mean, we can look at the State Department website, but that's not what they're, you know, when they're talking to the media. It's all the time, and we're hearing very little else. And I think that has to do with the fact, and we will probably dig deeper into this as we go along. There's a lack of any sort of, coherence in the team, like in his foreign policy team, right? People come, they go, you know, maybe if Bolton had stayed, even Cuba policy would be a little bit more coherent than it is right now.
I agree that there's not that much coherence. I should probably say that I'm an employee of the federal government, and I need to make it clear that the views that I'm expressing are not those of the federal government, the Department of Transportation, or the Maritime Administration, all of whom are my employers. But I agree there's not a whole lot of coherence. And I'm also curious, like, if there has to be, right? Because, you know, your first comment, Dustin, was that this is a wide region. And, you know, to some extent, it wouldn't make any sense to have similar kinds of policies towards Brazil and towards Nicaragua and towards Cuba. And I think that in some ways the lack of coherence is a function of some things that are important, some things that are not important, right? There are trade relationships going on with certain countries. And there's not, I think in large part, in a lot of places, there's not a lot of concern or interest in what's going on in Latin America. I have a hard time imagining that President Trump or anybody close to President Trump is thinking systematically about Latin America. And it's probably not the worst, you know, in considering what's going on in the world, I don't necessarily know that that's a criticism.
Actually, ignoring Latin America these days is a good thing. Just like, then you don't screw it up.
That's fair.
When you have such large economies, I mean, you have Brazil, what, the seventh or eighth largest economy in the world, you have Mexico, 14, 15, I mean, you have some serious economic prospects in the region that are completely ignored under the administration. I mean, no administration has really pursued robust economic ties with Brazil, so it's not that the Trump administration is any different in this regard, but it seems sort of ridiculous from just a purely economic that you wouldn't try to, you know, forge some stronger ties, economic ties in the region.
Which I agree with, though we got to remember Obama was constantly criticized for ignoring or losing Latin America, Bush was. So some of that, there's some continuity.
Yeah. And also in terms of Brazil, and I assume we'll talk about Bolsonaro a little bit. I mean, there is a place where he has made an effort to forge closer ties. I'm not sure if there's going to be how much economic opportunity is going to come out of those ties, but I'm not sure what else you'd ask, say, I'm not sure from the perspective of U.S.-Brazilian relations, what he could do better, right? They're about as close as many people in Brazil, whether they like Bolsonaro or not, is a whole other story. But in terms of forging a close relationship, I would think that, you know, Bolsonaro, you know, is among the best allies that he's got.
I just want to throw this out there because I'm not sure I have a good read on this, but I think sort of after the end of the Cold War, I mean, the sort of positive agenda towards Latin America had to do with free trade. And so I think some of the issue is we have like populist leaders now, like in Bolsonaro and Trump. So how are they going to a free trade agreement between the two countries doesn't fit in with their domestic political agenda. And so then you get that tension with, like, I mean, to Maggie, I mean, I don't disagree with you, but you would need a much more establishment figures brokering that kind of a relationship. And I don't think they have the clout right now.
Well, potentially, but we did it with Mexico, right? We did it with AMLO. We renegotiated NAFTA, and maybe that's a somewhat easier nut to crack because obviously there's an existing agreement. But there is, I mean, there is a lot of room for bilateral trade and investment treaties that, you know, typically occur several layers below the top of the administration, and I don't see any indication that that's happening.
Is that the direction you think that regional economic relations are going to move in under administrations like Donald Trump's and some others that have in the region that have been skeptical of more multilateral kinds of agreements, right? For years, bipartisan U.S. administrations were looking for some version of a free trade area of the Americas to negotiate. That never happened, right? There was significant resistance that has probably culminated in the W. Bush administration. Donald Trump has been skeptical of those agreements. He did renegotiate NAFTA into the USMCA, although the scope of change isn't exactly clear of what the how significant that change is from one to the other. But do you think it'll be more sort of wheel and spoke bilateral kinds of agreements when we talk about regional economic cooperation or anything along those lines moving forward?
Yeah, I would definitely expect any administration, not a Trump administration, to continue with that policy, but perhaps on a two-track strategy, moving back to some more emphasis on multilateralism. I don't foresee the Trump administration going in that direction at all. I mean, the USMCA was really, as Greg was pointing out, for domestic political considerations, right? And there's no domestic constituency writ large for free trade or investment agreements with Brazil or other countries in Latin America.
No, one thing we haven't talked about, though, and certainly we wouldn't expect it of Trump or Bolsonaro, is climate or the environment. And so that's something that's ripe for multilateral work. And obviously, both countries are on fire and don't seem to be doing much about it.
We've brought up the U.S. relationship with Bolsonaro. And Greg, you wisely bring up sort of environmental concerns, really, in both countries. As I live in the West, and you know, my town was on fire 2 days ago. You know, I'm acutely sensitive to those types of issues. Bolsonaro is also sort of the example in the Western Hemisphere of one of these, let's say, leaders with authoritarian tendencies with whom Donald Trump has seemed to identify in a personal way. And U.S.-Brazilian relations, perhaps because of that sort of personal link, seem closer as a consequence. What do we make of that? Do we see any broader significance? Where does this fit into the larger picture?
I don't know. I'm becoming increasingly convinced that something larger is not too likely, but I'm just reminded of the news stories not long ago about how Trump's ambassador to Brazil was basically there trying to figure out ways to appeal to Trump's own constituencies on, I think it was ethanol, and defeating Bolsonaro's son. So I see it as like this very, very personal thing, but I just don't know whether anything significant is going to really come out of it, or if Trump even, or Bolsonaro himself, really care.
You might get a Trump Tower in Brasilia.
There you go.
Well,
golf courses.
I had been down in Sao Paulo just as the coronavirus was breaking, and having lots of conversations with Brazilian academics, and their take, and for what it's worth, was that they think that if Trump were to win in 2020, this would greatly improve Bolsonaro's chances of remaining in power for longer. That if Trump loses, people in Brazil who are following the U.S. would see this as a repudiation of Trump/Bolsonaroism, and reject Bolsonaro as people in the United States as. For what it's worth, I thought that was an interesting perspective on how these two relationships could impact each other. I'm a little skeptical of it, but I thought it was an interesting idea that people, and certainly I did see people were very much reading this relationship as the same thing, right? That they were saying you've got Trump, we've got Bolsonaro, they're cut from the same cloth, they're seeing the world the same way, they're acting the same way. And the people, again, I was talking to were mostly liberal academics at universities who were appalled by that. I think a lot of people in Brazil think that's amazing.
Although I think once you factor in the coronavirus and the complete lack of leadership in Brazil and what's happened since then, that's going to change a lot of people's perceptions of that presidency. And maybe it's going to be the same sort of thing with the Trump administration. But I think at the end of the day, people vote their own self-interest. And when you have a president who has failed to lead the country through this pandemic in any way that's minimized deaths, and that may change their calculation.
Well, but it may be the same thing in the United States. This is the sense I have in Brazil, that it's playing out the same way, that the people who are Bolsonaro's are Bolsonaro supporters first and believe that he's doing a great job on the coronavirus. And I think that that's the same thing that's happening in the United States. People are seeing the coronavirus through their own political lenses rather than vice versa. And again, you know, elections will tell these things.
It's like a depressing demonstration effect where it's like what the direction Brazil takes, it depends on whether American voters are smart.
And the economic consequences of the coronavirus are bad enough in the United States. They're worse in Brazil. I can't imagine at the end of the day that's not going to have more of an effect on people's vote than, you know, this sort of who you like is the most fierce populist.
His numbers, and I haven't seen numbers recently, so somebody's seen Bolsonaro approval numbers recently, but they're down, but I didn't think that they were crazy down, right?
And they have to figure out whether somebody from the PT is going to be, you know, popular enough for people to want to vote for as an alternative. I mean, we already get Trump voters saying that Joe Biden is practically, you know, he's going to cause riots in every city, and the ghost of Lula kind of hangs over all of that in Brazil. So
there may be fewer alternatives in Brazil to Bolsonaro than there are in the United States to Trump. Is that what you're saying?
Of just whether you could get enough people in the quote unquote opposition to gather around one person. Biden is very establishment, very well known, and the PT I don't study Brazil, but it's my sense is that it's kind of in disarray, and it was seen as extremely corrupt, so that people aren't really anxious to vote for it again right away.
Yes, the anti-Bolsonaro people know what they don't like.
Yeah.
What they like is another question.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking a little bit about COVID impacts, especially, you know, given the significance in Brazil, certainly in the United States. COVID doesn't know borders. We have a transnational, multinational public health challenge in the hemisphere. To what extent do we see this, any kind of cooperation at a government level in the region to address this sort of shared challenge, recognizing that you have leaders like Bolsonaro, like AMLO in Mexico, who have been skeptical of the degree of significance of the virus at various times, other leaders who have taken it far more seriously. Again, is there any way that we can generalize or talk about levels of state-to-state or multilateral cooperation in the face of this public health emergency?
Sure. You know, I'm not seeing anything coherent. Arguably the two most powerful countries in the region, the US and Brazil, we've been talking about, are having a failed response and are certainly not stepping up to take any sort of regional leadership. And I would think Canada might be a better candidate for trying to, but I think Canada's just sort of like, we'll just seal off the border and you all just sort of, you just deal with that down there. So I don't really see their government sort of stepping into the breach there. So I'm not seeing much of a coherent response. I mean, and we can, I mean, in it regionally, or I mean, quite frankly, even globally.
I can't think of anything. I mean, and who would lead it? But I don't see anything coming out of, let's say, the OAS or anyone else. I mean, everybody is on their own. I mean, it's a great question because it's actually something that should be like the highest priority for multilateral response.
Yeah, you just think in terms of travel restrictions and those sort of things, it was very much, you know, close the gates as quickly as possible and shunt the problem off to somebody else. I mean, you know, the coronavirus came to Mexico from the United States. I mean, Ecuador was more seeded from Europe, from Spain and elsewhere, but we had, you know, to Guatemala, to other countries, it came from here, right? But our response was, you know, we're going to close out the border because we don't want you all infecting us, when in fact it was the opposite.
Yeah, and I think often the response was absolutely pointing the finger at other countries. So it like poisoned things right away, where it's like, well, it wasn't our problem, but now all these other foreigners are coming in, everybody blaming Venezuelans or blaming, you know, whomever, which makes it even harder to work together.
Right, which is really kind of sad, because if you can't see a global pandemic as an impetus for concerted action multilaterally, then in so many other ways, you're not going to go for that response as well.
Just one thought, though. I mean, it's difficult. I think one of the issues that Latin American countries are facing is it's difficult in conditions where there's poverty in slums, and certainly in favelas in places like Brazil, and certainly slums in other parts. That's harder to deal with a pandemic like this, right? In more industrialized countries, more urbanized countries, you know, in Spain or in France, it may be possible to shut down the economy. And I think that's much harder, and something that Latin America, it's not just Latin America, you know, in India, this is the problem. I mean, in the poorer parts of the world, the materially poorer parts of the world, that the disease has, it's much more difficult to challenge the disease. And certainly I think that's what the Latin Americans, you know, it's what the struggle going on in Latin America. And I'm not sure if there's any, I think it's what maybe Greg was saying, I don't know if there's solutions to that, right? And what multinational activity might possibly do about that.
Or what you're going to do with a vaccine. So I think right now the developed countries have come together for about, you know, to make up to about 4 billion vaccines. Well, obviously the developed world's going to get those vaccines. Is Latin America going to get those vaccines? Is the United States going to help Latin America get those vaccines? I mean, that is going to be a huge issue. Yeah, I don't see the Latin America ranking high for us in terms of distribution.
Yeah. And these seem to be the big unanswered questions. At least I haven't found good answers to these questions. You could imagine other administrations, the H.W. Bush administration, even the W. Bush administration, based on the precedent of the work it did on AIDS in Africa, certainly the Obama administration, if in power in a situation like this, trying to create multilateral frameworks for research, development, distribution of vaccines, of all of those kinds of things. I haven't seen evidence of that happening, even at sort of a secondary level of diplomatic talks either at this stage.
No, I mean, and even from a purely self-interest point of view, the U.S. should be interested in getting Mexico vaccinated as widely as possible, just because of the sheer amount of movement of people. And yet, really, what do we have? AMLO saying, oh, yeah, we're gonna take the Russian vaccine. And so there's, you know, you would think that any administration in the United States would want to be able to make sure that people on their borders had access to the vaccine. We're definitely not seeing that.
Well, I was going to say, I think, Dustin, that kind of segues into your one of the other questions you pose, which is the racism, right? And dehumanization. I mean, it's going to be hard for the Trump administration to make a sort of humanitarian case to get vaccines to these countries where, you know, they've been busy, you know, they're white nationalists in the White House, white supremacists in the White House have been busy completely dehumanizing. I mean, we're living, it's just like, never mind coronavirus, little children are dying in cages of the flu here in the U.S. Like, I mean, I don't see a Trump administration possibly being able to lead or even wanting to lead any sort of humanitarian effort.
I want to get back to that in a second. I just want to make one more comment about the coronavirus stuff, because, you know, I do think that this is, there may be, there's a standard of, or let's say it this way, that there's so many unknowns and the situation is so complicated that expecting effective planning, and clearly there has not been good planning. I'm not denying that, but we don't know when a vaccine is going to come, if a vaccine is going to come, where it's going to come from, how many doses are going to come from. And so, certainly I think it makes sense to get people in the United States to have that vaccine first. And with so many unknowns, I think developing an international strategy is very difficult. I'm not saying that there's not an opportunity to do better, but I'm saying, but I do think it's hard to say, let's worry about Mexico having, I think it's sort of lack, beyond whatever is white racism or nationalism or any kind of stuff like that. I think it would be, you know, in the interest of the President of the United States to sort of make sure that this vaccine, if it ever comes, and is distributed in the United States more effectively soon. I'm not sure they're planning for that, because I don't think they know where it's coming from and how it's going to be distributed. I mean, there's too many unknowns here in this question, I think, to go down to sort of think how would we multilaterally distribute this vaccine across the world. But we should probably get back to this racism question that Mary Beth.
Well, one thing about that, though, is that I don't think we have to get to the – we have to expect, like, nuts and bolts knowledge of exactly how it's going to work. But if you think about hemispheric leadership, it's the idea that, okay, well, how do we figure out a way that certainly from a U.S. president's perspective is going to help the U.S., but is going to also help serve as a model or as not as a model exactly, but as a way to help the hemisphere as well, because we're constantly talking about it. So I don't the complete lack of that I do see as problematic, even if we can't predict.
I agree with you. The thing, though, is this is an elephant that's I was going to say elephant that can't change its spots. That's wrong. This is a tiger that's not tiger's spots. Tiger's stripes.
Leopard.
Leopard. Chain. I don't know.
We can mix in the room. Metaphors, you know, all day long.
This again, it gets to these questions about we should get to about racism and perception. But this is an administration that has said we're going to be protectionist. This is America first. And if you said America first, the job of the President of the United States is not to make the rest of the world better. The job of the United States is to make the United States better and to heck with everybody else and and make it all transactional. That instinct is very much not there. And I'm not saying it shouldn't be there. I think I agree with you. It should be there, but it's clearly not there.
So Jeff, I like that word that you use, transactional, because I think that is exactly right. Hits a nail on the head as far as a Trump policy approach in general, right? And so I'm wondering how that sort of fits in with sort of traditional U.S. policy towards Latin America, which is, I mean, generally dominated, right, sort of by the realist ideas, which do tend towards a kind of a zero-sum mentality. But I think there's always been room for, like, hey, democracy promotion could, you know, also benefit us. Hey, free trade, you know, could have, you know, we could have shared benefits. So I've been wondering how people, like, is this a departure? Because, like, MAGA, like, sort of sounds like it would fit in with a traditional realist approach. But is it more transactional than ever before?
I tend to think so. I mean, there's a lot of similarities, but it seems more openly like, I don't care what happens to you. And that part is new, and I think it's truly believed that we just don't care. We need to do what's best for us, and that's been absent from before, even if perhaps sometimes it was leaning that way. So that I see as a bit different.
And it's not as though foreign policy shouldn't always be based on the self-interest of the particular country that's developing the policy. But as Greg pointed out earlier, I mean, self-interest would indicate that you want people in Mexico to be vaccinated as well, right? So it's not as though these things are in contrast. And I mean, how many, what do we have? You know, a quarter of our foreign-born population is Mexican-born. I mean, we have a lot of Mexicans who live here, right? We have a lot of Mexican-Americans who vote and have other, you know, interests. So it's sort of stunning to see. Again, I mean, we ignored Latin America for a long time. We've treated Latin American racist ways for a long time. But this is a step further than ignoring, right? This is putting things in place that actually actively make things worse, I think.
I have strong opinions about this. I think that you know, Greg is right here. And what we're all saying here, that this is something that is really different that we've seen before, that there's an active voice saying, I'm not interested in international engagement, except in the most narrow way that we can clearly see some advantage for the United States. That this idea about democracy promotion, we don't care. And if you go back to what he said in the inaugural address, right? He essentially said, we've been suckers. The United States government has been suckers for 50 years back to the cold, back to the beginning of the cold, all this foreign aid. And I'm writing a book about people who are who oppose foreign aid. And so this is plays very much into in the history of people who oppose foreign aid. Little plug for my book, which is not out yet, but will be hopefully in 2021. but there's this whole history of people who oppose foreign aid. And he's saying that they're right. The rest of, you know, the political leaders were giving this money away. We're building up other countries, building up other political systems. We've been a sucker. We've gotten nothing back from all of that money. And let's stop that. Right. And so that instinct is, which by the way, is popular in the United States, right? I mean, he's reflecting how Americans feel about what the United States has done. Many Americans feel what the United States has done, not all, but certainly many Americans feel the United States did during the Cold War period and afterwards, that we gave too much money away, that we helped meet other people, and we've got our own problems. We should have been focusing on that.
I think this starts getting back to Mary Rose's point, though, is that a lot of that is Stephen Miller driven, and there's this sense of, for Latin America anyway, that why would we give money to those people? You don't give money to those people. They're not capable of it. We need it for our people.
Well, I think there's a whole layer. I mean, there's layers and layers of the bureaucracy that we're sort of ignoring here, right? And one of the things that may be really different about the Trump administration is the extent to which they've been able to hollow out those layers of the bureaucracy that sort of keep right things going in terms of foreign policy. I mean, Congress has provided a check in terms of keeping a lot of funding for foreign aid to Latin America and elsewhere from the Trump administration's, you know, scalpel. But there are, you know, in terms of just a robust set of seasoned foreign policy actors that are working with our partners in Latin America, that's what's really been hollowed out, I think. And that's where you really have these issues of keeping things going, even the programs that you have thus far. I mean, the Operation Warp Speed, the people who are running it are the military in terms of distribution. Our military can figure out how to distribute vaccines in a very efficient and effective way throughout the region. I mean, they have partnerships throughout Latin America, right? As we all know. So I don't think it's so much a problem of capacity, but you have to mobilize that capacity. And that's where I see the Trump administration really putting roadblocks rather than pushing that forward.
Let's deal with this issue of racism and white nationalism in the Trump administration, and certainly with some of Trump's supporters head on, right? Because I think we've seen white nationalism and racist tropes as something of a persistent feature under Trump, going back to, you know, rapists and criminals coming in from Mexico in the 2016 campaign. At a minimum, I would say that you're looking at an administration that is tolerant of white nationalists and racists. And I would go further and say that you could identify some, your Millers and so on, in the administration directly. In Latin American policy, I think that this has probably manifested itself most clearly in immigration policy, family separation policy, and the like, which is also one of the more visible elements of U.S. policy towards Latin America to domestic audiences, right? Looking at questions of immigration. We've already identified some other areas where racialized and outright racist ideas could come into play in a policymaking sense. What do we as a panel make of the significance of, I would argue, more explicit racist tropes than we've seen in recent years, right? You know, historians of U.S. Latin American relations can document this over the decades and the centuries, but I'm not sure that we've seen this as explicit and as pronounced openly in, you know, the last generation or so. How about Maggie? Do you want to start us off with this one?
Well, I guess it's, and when it comes to immigration, for me, that's the area that I study the most. It is blindingly clear that immigration policy has a lot to do with race, right? From the Muslim ban to our border policies and those sorts of things. And I think Stephen Miller has been masterful. MPI has a recent report on all the changes in immigration of the Trump administration, 400 executive orders on immigration. And so the Trump administration has been able to use the power of the executive branch in ways that have completely shut down our asylum process, right? Completely shut down a lot of, at least asylum seeking over the southern border and other types of migration as well. But it goes further than that, right? It goes to economic migrants, right? It goes to immigrants from all over the world. And so I think that, that racism and white supremacy is an important component of it, but it's not the only component of it. They see migration as they see everything else as a zero-sum game, and thus migration must be stopped.
And I think it's notable that Stephen Miller is one of the few high-level officials in the administration who has stayed there. So him like Betsy DeVos. So when you've got that kind of continuity, you know you got a lot of influence.
There's a handful of survivors in the Trump administration. Stephen Miller's
the hardcore.
Well, it's not apparent that there are any controls on what he does. I mean, I think Trump has sort of ceded that whole area of policy to him, and he's just going to town. I mean, it's amazing the levels at which they've been able, you know, from the public charge rule to all the changes on asylum process. I mean, the Justice Department cracking down on immigration judges. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. I mean, you talk about a well-ordered, you know, set of policies to restrict immigration. They've pursued them, and they've pursued them incredibly effectively.
It's actually terrifying. I mean, because like they're doing illegal things. The courts have said what they're doing is illegal, and no, like, right. But they control the executive branch, and nobody is enforcing this. And I, you know, which does not bode well for our democracy, especially, you know, when you throw in a dehumanization along with it. I find it incredibly terrifying that they can create. I mean, these are pretty heinous human rights abuses that are happening in public and that courts in some cases have said are not legal, and they're still happening.
I mean, I think one of the ways that I think about this is, again, in this larger idea about the United States have been a sucker for so long, right? And this is the idea that they're presenting, that we've had these borders that have been open for so long, and this was a mistake because all of these people who were not American and clearly being defined as not American and honestly are not American, they're coming from other countries. They may become American over time, but these non-Americans are coming and transforming an American society. And this is the right wing talking point, are a burden on American society and a burden on the systems that exist in the United States. And this is an effort to stop this. And so, you know, I agree that this is deeply problematic stuff. But at the same time, this is what he promised he would do. This is not a surprise. He said, I'm going to stop this thing from happening. And this is, it's certainly not a new problem. The immigration, the border has been, is a long problem. I'm obviously not suggesting that the way it's been handled is good. I have all the same concerns about the legal stuff. But this is what the American people voted for.
But I mean, here's the thing, though, right? At least the data from Pew show that deportations in Obama's first administration were, I mean, Obama was much more effective at actually doing the things that Trump said he was going to do. And when I was like looking for those numbers, I just found that like actually really interesting that there's like all these right-wing conspiracy theories who are bending over backwards to be like, no, it's not really true that Obama deported more people in his first term than Trump. And I don't know if that's just because, like Maggie, like the hollowing out of bureaucracy, like they just don't have the capacity, you know, in these bureaucracies anymore to do this.
I think it has more to do with all hands on deck on the southern border. I mean, when the numbers just skyrocketed in 2019, I mean, they originally sent ICE out on the streets, right, particularly in so-called sanctuary cities here in Charlotte. But then they had to sort of, they had this explosion of people coming over across the southern border, and they just sent everybody there. And once that became sort of, you know, they got the handle on that, then COVID happened. So they actually had all these plans to send ICE out in higher numbers. But then COVID got in the way of that. They felt like it wasn't safe enough to do it. So it's less a matter of, you know, ability to do it than just having other things, you know, policy being pulled in other directions, I think. I fully expect in the second administration, if there were a second Trump administration, you would see a whole lot more interior enforcement than we're seeing now.
Thinking of Jeff's point, one thing that's really, it always strikes me is that in thinking of, you know, this is what we expect, is that Trump's clearly interested in Florida, and an easy win in Florida would be temporary protected status for Venezuelans. And it's not happening because that constituency, that core constituency, also pushed by Stephen Miller, says, no, we don't want any of that. TPS is definitely the U.S. being a sucker because they never leave. And from a political standpoint, it would be just an easy move for Trump to win Florida. But he's not doing it. He's actually ceding that to Biden.
Let's talk Venezuela policy for a moment, because that's one of the areas that gets a fair amount of attention in the United States, perhaps in part because Donald Trump and you know, Senator Cruz and others are able to point to Venezuela as this sort of socialist, communist train wreck, borderline failed state, as a warning for others. It can also be an entry point into Cuba policy, which we can talk about. But the administration has defined regime change as a policy objective in Venezuela, and has embraced opposition leader Juan Guaido to the point that he even made an appearance at the, I think it was the last State of the Union address, as one of Donald Trump's guests in the gallery. What do we make of Washington's continued efforts to take down the Nicolas Maduro government? You know, so here we have an authoritarian regime of the left that, you know, that perhaps a different approach from the Trump administration than a quasi-authoritarian regime on the right in Bolsonaro. You know, is this just a manifestation of typical sort of U.S. policy towards leftist governments in the region, especially GOP policy towards leftist governments in the region? Is this something that Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz care about more than anybody in the White House? What do we make of U.S. policy towards Venezuela? And how about Greg? Do you want to start us off?
So, I mean, for a long time, I was thinking that Trump's policy toward Venezuela was just kind of a tightening of Obama's, because Obama had already gone, you know, he'd had individual sanctions and things like that. But then, you know, Trump, of course, expanded it quite a bit with the sanctions. But I see it as even more failed, because what he did was he raised expectations really high with all kinds of talk of everything is on the table, clearly suggesting that invasion was possible, some armed use of armed force. And I can't help thinking that he has really helped Maduro, because Maduro still stands after all of these threats. And ultimately what Trump did was just more sanctions. And at least up to now, Maduro's finding help from Russia, Iran, and wherever else. So I think it's failed in a pretty major way.
Cuba 2.0.
Yeah, well, in this case, too, is that, you know, the Venezuelan opposition appeared united, and now it's blowing up again.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is odd. And I mean, it's interesting that, you know, Elliot Abrams is sort of back, or he never goes away. But it is, you know, it's just like a lack of original sort of, you know, this Cold War thinking is just, I mean, I feel like that is almost, I mean, that's not a Trump thing, right? I mean, Trump, it might work with their transactional agendas. It might work for sound bites for them, but that's a constant.
Yeah, I don't see this as a Trump thing. I mean, I think your point, Dustin, about this is what Rubio cares about and what Cruz cares about is probably to some extent driving the bus. I think there was a moment where Donald Trump sort of felt emotional about this, and things for him seemed to be personal, and he'd gotten angry about this and sort of made a connection with the Venezuelan opposition. It's clearly, and I agree with Greg's point that this has probably helped out Maduro in identifying the United States as an interventionist enemy. But I'm not really sure what the United States does that's different here if it's not Trump. That if it's any Republican, this would be a similar kind of policy towards Venezuela. This is not a great guy. I mean, I would push back, you know, you would sort of made the equivalency between Bolsonaro and Maduro. I don't think that those are equivalent. But Bolsonaro is a freely elected, fairly elected democratic leader. I think there are real questions about Maduro and, you know, his efforts to create an alternative legislature, which is going to support him against the other legislature. I think that this is a regime, again, that's hard to call a free and fair democratic government. And the question is, should the United States be opposed to that? That's a whole nother story that gets us into the questions of, you know, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, right? If you leave it alone, then you're allowing some government that's not good to be out there. If you're intervening, you're becoming imperialistic, and there's problems on both ends of that stick. But I don't know that that other than making it personal, I don't know what else Donald Trump would have done differently than any other Republican in the White House.
Well, let me frame it in a slightly different way then. You know, if there's general agreement that Nicolas Maduro is not the greatest of leaders, it seems to me, and I think Greg or somebody brought this up already, that there are elements of this policy that can be counterproductive and in some ways ensconce Maduro even further by associating with Guaido and associating with the opposition, and then it's the Colossus of the North is back again and everything else. If the policy objective is regime change, it seems like you could make an argument that they just are kind of terrible at it in the first place, right? Is there a better way, if that's the policy objective, to achieve the policy objective with less blowback on Washington as a consequence, correct?
Well, I was going to say there's two. We kind of have two questions because what Jeff is saying, I'm actually tend to agree with, is that I don't know if there was another one of the other front runners back in 2015, 2016. Would they be doing something substantively different? And you could pretty easily think, well, no, it's not going to be very different. But then we would, so it depends on whether we're asking that question or the question of, is there a way to do this better that actually gets toward whatever U.S. policy goal, which generally now is some kind of democratic transition. Regime change, I tend to think of as more by force, but if there's some sort of democratic transition, at least an election or something, is there a better way of doing it? In my opinion, yes. There's no easy answers, but I do tend to think that if there had been a president of, one of those other, President Rubio, I don't know, that'd be a heck of a lot different. Maybe Bolton would have convinced him to invade. I don't know, but it wouldn't have been better.
It may have put more emphasis behind some of the multilateral processes as well. And one of the things the Trump administration didn't do well is to mobilize even the OAS, right, to kick Venezuela out. That first vote, they didn't go around and try to lobby other governments, particularly Caribbean governments, to try to get them on. They lost that first vote because they didn't know how the system ran. They have such disdain for multilateral organizations that they sort of blew that. And they've gotten their act together a little bit since then. But I think a Rubio administration would have been a little bit better about using the engines of the U.S. government to approach this. I would also say, in terms of Venezuela, right now it's a big boon to the Trump administration because they're making huge political hay out of this socialism in Venezuela, right? So Venezuela is socialist and you don't want to be socialist. And, Joe Biden is a socialist, or he's a Trojan horse for socialists. So, I mean, to call Venezuela socialist is, maybe in at most partially true, right? That's not what's creating most of the problems in Venezuela. But the Trump administration is making tremendous political hay out of that because everybody has seen the pictures of Venezuelans fleeing and hospitals without medicine and all those sort of things.
I do like your question, though, Dustin, because it sort of makes me think, like, what would Eisenhower have done, right, to this, right?
Overt action.
Yeah, I was going to say the CIA.
Overt action, and I did find, and again, I think we don't know the whole story yet about this crazy sort of invasion plan and who was involved.
The William thing. Walker version two?
Is this William Walker? Is this the Arbenz? The CIA, at least in Guatemala in 54, knew how to do it right. You plan the thing. You get a lot of people involved. You get some weaponry involved. You really train people to do some sort of regime change or invasion, or what they do in 64 in Brazil, right? Work with the military, really get people involved and really put the time in and the effort in to do a coup effectively. If you want to really make regime change, you got to spend the time and the money on making it happen. I'm not suggesting that we should, but this is what the Cold War folks would have said.
But Jeff, a lot of the historians of the Cold War say actually they got lucky, right? They got lucky in Iran and they got lucky in Guatemala, and they followed the same game plan in Cuba, and it didn't work. It's odd that those analyses have come out, right? The official CIA histories. And yet it seems like this last little coup attempt was out of that same playbook.
Right, because the alternative, and I agree with you, because the alternative is doing is pulling Iraq and sending troops into Venezuela, and that's not in the world of plausible.
Surely you could cultivate ties with parts of the Venezuelan military that would like to see Maduro go, right? I mean, that's a little bit more of a finesse type of approach.
Brazil 64 examples better.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back to that great boogeyman of U.S. policy in the region in Cuba since 1959, right? With sanctions since 1961. Towards Cuba in an effort to, again, regime change broadly defined, not necessarily through military means, but to change the nature of the government. That's been a long-term objective in Cuba. Now, the Barack Obama administration famously attempted a different approach, attempted an opening toward Havana late in its administration. Donald Trump reversed that decision. Again, I think consistent with the sort of the Marco Rubio Cruz sort of wing of the party and traditional sort of approach towards Cuba, even though the sanctions approach had not been effective since, 1961, I think, is when the 61 or 62, the Kennedy sanctions were first implemented. Why do we see this reversal? Is this again sort of typical GOP fare? Is Venezuela policy in many ways an attempt to get back towards Cuba policy for the Trump administration broadly or the GOP broadly? What do we make of the place of Cuba in U.S. policy making in 2020?
I do think that it is, again, sort of similar to Venezuela in that this is sort of typical Republican fare. I've been thinking about this a lot. I mean, my imagination is that absent change in Cuba, this is going to be sort of a political football that's sort of equivalent to like the abortion funding one, where each president comes along and they change that policy on how we're spending foreign aid on this. And I would assume that if Biden wins, he's going to come in and reverse the policy on Cuba. And theoretically, let's say Biden only has a 4-year term and some Republican comes in, they'll reverse the policy back. And I would think that this is – I can see easily that this just, again, without change, absent change in Cuba, that this is just going to be more about domestic politics and what Republicans say they stand for and what Democrats are saying they stand for.
Yeah, I buy that. But one thing that I'm always wondering about is we've seen changes in public opinion and generational change of Cuban Americans in Florida. So I tend to think that the hardcore Republican support for the broad embargo is a lot weaker than it used to be. It's almost like this knee jerk, this is what you do. If you're Republican, this is what you do. But I don't think Trump even overwhelmingly won with Cuban Americans in Florida. I'd have to go back and look, but eventually I just wonder, maybe, I don't know, 4 years is enough where it's like, well, why are we... Do we even have a constituency for this?
Yeah, I don't think it's a constituency thing. I think it is just, this is what Republicans believe in. This is what Tom Cotton's going to believe in. These are the kinds of things that, it's sort of what counts for being a hawk today, right? Is how you feel about or satisfying the hawk element or whatever is left of the hawk element of the Republican Party. This is how you show America is tough.
With no risk.
With no risk, absolutely.
Right.
No.
So so this is one way, right? Because, Trump's policy on Cuba, some have summed up as a keeping Senator Rubio happy, right? And I mean, he's sort of conceded, like, it's a little thing he could concede in it. And I agree, Jeff, with, it fits into a larger pattern, but it also fits into a Trump pattern, which is, Rubio gets what he wants and I get to, erase Obama's legacy. And there's one other thing.
And Rubio is loyal and sucks up to Trump in public.
But at the end of the day, Republicans have to win Florida to be in the White House, or almost always. And so the electoral politics dominate it. And I'm with you, Greg. I haven't looked at the numbers, but this certainly was the narrative under the Obama administration, right? That Cubans were younger, Cuban voters, Cuban American voters were younger, that they were trending Democratic, that they wanted more engagement with Cuba. And having opened up that door to that kind of engagement, it's really hard to shut it again, I think. There's a lot of people who don't like the policy in Florida. And Venezuelan Cuba and old Cubans are not the only Latin Americans in Florida, right? You have Puerto Ricans are obviously Americans, not Latin Americans, but you have other constituencies that don't like the policy. So I would think his strategists would be a little bit nervous about it at a minimum.
But it also, it's somebody, I forget who said this, it plays in this idea of socialism being bad, right? And that the Democrats are like the Cubans, and this is what we're fighting against. So even if these are not really about Cubans anymore, and specifically Cubans in Florida, this is about a larger idea of how Republicans are trying to paint Democrats as socialist. And so, again, there are other socialist governments out there, and it's kind of, you know, there's not a lack, there's a marketing of what's happening in Cuba rather than a reality of Cuba. They're not concerned with socialists in Denmark. They're they're concerned with the socialists in Cuba.
But any thoughts about Donald Trump's efforts to get a U.S. citizen, his NSC Latin America specialist, Mauricio Claver Corón, installed as the head of the Inter-American Development Bank? If successful, it would be the first U.S. citizen as opposed to Latin American citizen. Latin American country, if you can certainly make a case that there's plenty of Latin America in the United States, but the first time a U.S. citizen headed the IDB.
Just an effort, I think, for the Trump administration to just hammer home his will. And from what I gather, he's just trying to lean on Latin American governments to support it, right? That's sort of, I don't know whether there's a whole lot more of just like that, this is what I want, and I'm just waiting. Isn't it this weekend, the vote? Waiting to see
so.
whether they cave or not.
As I understood it, there were, again, Brazil was backing it fairly strongly on the promise that the number two would be a Brazilian.
Oh, I didn't see that.
And I think the Argentines and I think Mexico and maybe a couple other countries were really trying to lead a charge in the opposite direction.
What's the voting structure? Is it one country, one vote, or is it by shares in the bank, or?
That's a good question.
I think one country. I might be wrong, though.
I mean, one thing that's interesting about this is, and you see this with AMLO in Mexico, and I'm not sure specifically about this situation, but it's interesting to not that there's been not necessarily little resistance, but relatively little resistance in Latin America to Trump, and especially in this, what's fascinating to me in Mexico, that AMLO has said, you know, he writes a book about how awful Trump is and how he's going to fight Trump and be the anti-Trump in Mexico, and I think other people on the left and even in the center in Latin America were complaining about this guy and saying we're going to stand up to Trump, but when push comes to shove, or not push comes to shove, when Trump says let's have a meeting, they come up, they're all smiles, and AMLO's sitting down and agreeing to stuff I can't believe that he's agreed to. Like, I am shocked at the, and again, it's sort of interesting that the Trump people are not using this as campaign fodder, because I don't think it's going to sell in the American public. I don't think really people are that focused on this new trade deal and the nuts and bolts of this new trade deal. But I'm shocked. I think it's a clear win for the Trump administration in terms of what they wanted to do and getting the Mexicans and the Canadians to give up stuff. This seems like, you know, again, I'm not fully an expert in this, but from what I read, and you know, it seems like a better deal was for the United States than NAFTA was, and the Mexicans didn't have to sit down. The Mexicans could have fought harder, but I think AMLO said, we can work with this guy. Let's try to pacify him. You know, he's moved troops up to the northern. He moved the special. There's a police force. He moved up to the northern border. Maybe Margaret knows more about this than I do. To try to stop some of the flow of migrants up there on Trump's request. This is Latin American leaders saying, not that we're behind this guy, but we kind of are willing to work with him and want to engage him and don't see him as deeply problematic we don't see him as problematic enough that we're not willing to play the ball game.
I mean, the outcome of this vote is going to be very interesting with the IDB, because the IDB, I mean, in terms of my research, because I do a lot of policy research, it funds a ton of policy agendas and policy research in Latin American countries. And so Claudio Caron comes in, I mean, I don't know much about him other than he's a big Cuba hawk. I don't know if this is just symbolic, like Greg, you said, just, you know, we want to show that we can sort of control these things, or does somebody have a policy agenda? Because this could have some serious ramifications in terms of what policies get funded, what research gets funded. And I'm not sure if maybe Latin American countries figure more of a symbolic position. We don't really think much is going to change, you know, at the middle management level where most of this stuff happens. But I think it's definitely, I'm glad you brought that up, Dustin, because it's definitely merits watching.
I know that Rubio and Bob Menendez, who's got bipartisan support, but that's about as hawkish a Democrat as you're going to find, at least in the Senate, on Latin America and Cuban kinds of issues, have backed this. He appears to be a professional, although, you know, again, a sort of the standard kind of hawkish fare on Latin America policy.
Greg? For something like the IDB, I could easily see it as coming back to, we're not going to be suckers anymore. And so if our money is going into something, we are going to make sure that this money doesn't go to anything that we don't like, period. I could see it as really as simple as that.
And I think when you're, you know, seeking to explore AMLO's motivations for what he did, I mean, it's the economy, right? Mexico's economy is so deeply tied with the United States, 90%+ of exports, all the inter-firm trade that goes on. He didn't have a choice. Right. When Trump, you know, you take a seat at the table and you try to maintain some of the benefits of that agreement, or you just get steamrolled. So, and the same is true with deploying the forces to the north. I mean, what's stunning to me is that a Mexican president, right, in a country that is so fiercely nationalistic, has so bowed down to this administration. They don't really have a choice. I mean, they've lost, 10% of GDP over the past, since COVID started. I mean, year over percent. I mean, I think at the height we were less than 3%. I mean, that's some serious economic pain they're going through. And so
he's afraid of being tweeted at.
Yeah.
He gets tweeted at.
You're getting away from my economic argument, Greg.
Seriously. It just blows everything up. Like, let's just keep him happy.
Yeah. Below the radar.
Right. I think it'll be interesting to one day see those internal Mexican conversations about how to deal with Trump and the thought process on this. And from my understanding that there was an idea about trying to raise wages in Mexico, that these ideas about having more, I guess it's, the deal was 40% of all the auto imports need to be produced by workers who are making minimum wage. Is that correct?
Yeah, increasing.
Yeah, and so the idea that that's going to increase Mexican wages, maybe, and maybe that's why AMLO said that he wants to get behind this thing.
See, Mexican wages in those sectors are already higher. It wouldn't affect the wages in other companies, just the wages in companies that are part of the trade.
Yeah, that was my thought too.
I know that our time is short. I want to thank all of you, Maggie, Mary Rose, Jeff, and Greg for coming on. This has been a great conversation about the Trump administration's approach towards Latin America. My hope is that we can regroup at some point in the future after an election and see what maybe a Trump 2 or a Biden administration might have in store. Continuities, change, all of those good questions. Thank you so much for coming on. This has been an episode of Historias, the podcast from the Southeastern Council of Latin American Studies. I'm Dustin Walcher. On behalf of the entire Historias team, thanks for listening.